From NPR Music, you're connected to All Songs Considered. I'm Bob Boylan. Today, I have a treat not just for you, but for me as well. I'm about to talk to one of my musical heroes, the man I have more songs by in my record collection than anyone shy of the Beatles. Ray Davies wrote music for a band called the Kinks. Most of you know their catchy guitar riff-based songs. Their most adoring fans know them, however, as a band capable of writing character-filled story tunes. That's me, all right. Ray came to our New York bureau. I'm here in Washington, D.C., having just listened to his second solo album in as many years. And yes, it's Davies, not Davies. In this edition of All Songs Considered, Ray Davies plays DJ. Who is the music junkie in your house?
Well, it was a large family, and I had, you know, six sisters, and there's a big age gap between us. And I, as a child, I listened to their music from their generation, you know, bebop, some jazz, other syrupy standards of the early 50s. And it came to me overhearing what they were dancing to and listening to their music.
Could you tell what it was about the music that, well, did you like the music you were hearing that was around the house? And if
Well, all I know is that my sisters really enjoyed it. And it was to see the change in them, you know, when the boyfriends came into the... We had a parlor, a front room, small. It's only a small house, and a piano in there. And they all got on the piano and they sang. But it's the way watching the girls, the different styles of girls. You know, that each dance had a characteristic to it, and each sister had their own sort of particular forte. That one could do the bebop, one was slinky and sexy, and you know, it was really interesting to watch. And also, I was an insomniac when I was a child. I still am, but they say that when I was an infant, they used to walk around, they hold me and walk around the room and play old gramophone records till I went to sleep. So I haven't changed very much. It's just my sisters aren't there to do it. I have to find other people to do it now.
Do you know what some of that music might have been?
My dad really liked Hoagy Carmichael. He liked... Dad also liked Cab Calloway, who was a big hero. I think my father used to imitate the dance that Cab Calloway did. So all these people, all these influences were from another generation, really. When I was evolving, as music was coming to me, I was really pre-rock and roll, and what we had in England called skiffle. Skiffle was, I think, a derivative of New Orleans music, you know, the washboard.
Absolutely.
And the stomping.
Jug band.
The jug band music. And hearing songs like San Francisco Bay, you know, played. It was quite a diverse assortment of music.
Pretty darn happy music, too, a lot of it. I mean, it had bluesy notes to it, but the music you're describing, you know, the Cab Calloways and the skiffle stuff is really up and fun.
It's up and fun because, you know, we're talking about the mid-50s, I suppose, late, and that's a time of austerity. You know, in England, we had food rationing until, I think, 1955. We had stamps. I remember going in as a child, going in to get some sweets on food stamps, get some candy, and stealing my brother's stamps to get my own candy. So it was quite an austere time.
So and was a counterbalance, you think, for?
I think the music helped people. The origins of that music, you know, blues, jug band music, came probably from very poor society. It was, and I think that was a way of alleviating the feeling of, you know, concern about where the next dollar was coming from, whatever.
Do you have a memory of either a song or a group we could play?
I don't know who'd do it. You know, the image I have in my head is someone like Woody Guthrie singing San Francisco Bay, but I don't think he ever did it. There is a good version, a sort of a jug bandy version of it, and if you can find it in your library, you know, I'd love to hear it. Didn't mean to treat us bad. The best girl I ever
she like to make me cry. I wanna lay down and die. I haven't got a nickel and ain't got a lot of dime. If she don't come back, I think I'm gonna lose my mind. If she ever come back to stay, turn another brand new day. Walking with the baby down by the San Francisco Bay.
My favorite songs vary from day to day. When I think of out and out influences, there's a callback I do in when we play All Day and All of the Night live, when I played with the Kinks and when I do it in my solo shows. And the influence of that was a track by Ray Charles called What I Say. He did in a club version. I think it was Ray Charles in person. That music really came to me really when I went to art college. And we heard it in our sort of playroom. You know, we had a room, student's room, and somebody had that record. And it really struck me. It didn't sound like a piano. I think it's a Fender Rhodes piano he plays. It was just the energy in it and the groove in it that I'd never really heard before. And it just struck me as being something really astoundingly original.
Let's give a listen to some of that for a generation that hasn't heard it, and for those who have, it still sounds pretty darn good. Still sounds good, huh?
How does
that happen?
You just don't, you know, just not thinking about it. It's the way the drums skip across the beat. Yeah. And it's just so great.
You've never tried to make the kind of music that people admire music. Sometimes they try to copy it. But not your early stuff. Didn't it all sound like that?
No. Yeah. You see, I don't think you can cover something like the What I Say version we just heard, the way the beats from the drums go across. You can organize it and arrange it and put it down, but the wonder is, the joyous thing about that is you can't duplicate it exactly. Mm-hmm. It's got literally what it is. It's kind of soul music. And I think the Kinks were influenced, my band were influenced by a lot of R&B. People like John Lee Hooker and obviously Big Bill Brunsey was a big influence mm-hmm. to me. But I never really tried to copy it because I knew it, the definitive way had been done. And it's all about feel and soul, as I said. I thought I'd make my own R&B music because, you know, I was just a honky from North London. So what did I know? I was just celebrating the music.
Did you go and see any of this kind of music when you were growing up? Sneaking anywhere?
Yeah, I went to the Marquee. I saw Sonny Boy Williamson play and had a wonderful English R&B band supporting him called the Cyril Davis All-Stars. If we had more time, I'd play one of Cyril's records. He was a great influence on the younger generation of musicians like myself and probably the Rolling Stones, the Yardbirds. He just brought the music in. It was Cyril Davis and also a man called Alexis Corner, mm-hmm. who was the godfather of British R&B. Blues. Yeah, he got me my first gig in a blues club.
What's your attraction to that stuff?
What's the attraction?
I mean, you could have gone listen to Peggy Lee or Perry Como or something, but
I know. Well, Perry, listen, my first performance in the front room at home at the party when I was 3.5 years old was Temptation, and I did the cover version of Perry Como.
Who knew?
So, you know, I love all that stuff. Yeah. And yeah, I did say syrupy ballads as well. My sisters love all. But I think the thing was, seeing the way the girls moved to that kind of music, I'd never seen that before. You know, ballroom dancing was very popular in England in the 50s when my sisters were growing up. And they used to go to a place called the Palais every Saturday. But this music that came in, this like Ray Charles and a lot of the early R&B stuff, made them move differently when they danced. And I guess now I know I was excited by it. I didn't realize it then.
Pick me something else.
Very quickly. We'll quickly move on. I think this next song, it's something that's in the psyche. And in England, we only had really two radio stations, BBC One, I think it was that was called the Light Programme for light music, and they had the Home Service for the serious people. And there was a station called Radio Luxembourg, which was offshore, and the American services that were still based in Europe at that time, they had their radio stations. And I think I must have access this next piece of music by overhearing those radio stations. And we had a program called Jazz Club that was on every week, and this one stuck in my mind. This is, again, it's just the joy of the riff. You know, really got me in All Day and All the Night by the Kinks are riffs. And this is probably one of the great riff songs, and it's a jazz song. It's called The Champ
by Dizzy Gillespie. Let's listen to it. Dizzy, of course, on the trumpet. Milt Jackson maybe on
probably.
Vibes.
Boy. Yeah.
But yeah, I hear what you mean just, by the riff.
It was just picking up the other riff, and then they do a great key change. You know, I love key changes in those things. It's organized chaos. It's wonderful.
We'll put the entire tune up online for folks to hear for this conversation. We'll get from song to song and hop quicker. You mentioned something earlier. You just mentioned art school, and it took me a long time as a kid growing up and listening to the music that you made and being in love with so many different British bands that there seemed to be a bit of a difference between the people who went to art school and the people who didn't. And I didn't even understand what the heck art school was. Can you explain any of that? Do you think there's a difference people who the types of people who wound up going to art school and the kind of music and stuff that they made?
Yeah, I think art school, you know, with all the exams and the post-war education, you know, the new generation, the baby boomers, if you like, I guess I'm one of those. I think if you weren't academic, you were an art student.
I see.
Simply, the divisions were very simple. But you have to take an exam to get to art school, and I got there on talent because I had no qualifications at all.
What was the talent?
Painting. Yeah. I could paint. It's something I always loved. And art, you know, still I revere great art because to me it's what I tried to do first, and maybe I didn't really go as far as I should with it. But art school was it was a rebellious place. It was a magical place and unpredictable and perfect breeding ground for lots of new culture, lots of new music. And yes, I think some of the Rolling Stones. In fact, Charlie Watts's wife, Shirley, was, I think, the Students' Union, head of the Students' Union at the college I went to. And she booked Charlie's band, Rolling Stones, to play. And I saw them play for £50, which is like $100. We booked them for $100, and we got in for nothing to see it. But Students' Union was a great place to have music like that. And I think it was a part of the new rebellion, the youth of that time passed through those doors at art school.
Do you think there was a more of a love from art students and appreciation of American jazz music?
What I found astounding and a big revelation for me is I do a picture, and whereas at school, you know, you just did a picture and you could tell by the perspective whether it's right. But art school enabled you to explain the creative process and indulge yourself more in how you come about to be creative. It taught me a lot, really. I left after 2 years. It was a 5-year course. But I learned how to understand how to get creative ideas a little bit more than if I'd, you know, just taken music. It was a big, it opened a door for me, certainly.
Did it help you become a storyteller?
I don't know about storytellers. I think my auntie Dorothy, uh-huh, was a big storyteller. But sitting around, you know, we used to go out to like a camp. The family was huge. The immediate family was large, but the general family, we used to get together for like conventions and sit around a log fire. And my gran used to tell stories. So I think a lot of that came from the home. Art school taught me more how to dig inside. Well, it didn't teach me. It enabled me to move inside myself and come up with creative ideas.
Can I play a new song? I'll play DJ for a second, play a song from your new CD, which I quite love. And there's some songs on there. That one in particular just made me think of it as you were telling me about your auntie, which is the title track, which is Working Man's Cafe. Can we play that and come
sure.
back? Great.
Looking for the working man's cafe in the shopping center of the town. Looking for somewhere to fit in among the retail outlets. Bought a pair of new designer pants where the fruit and veg man used to stand. I always used to see him there selling old apples and pears. Chatting up the pretty girls with knocked off goods in the van. Don't you know he was a working man? Long ago he was a working man. And we sat in the working man's cafe. The working man's cafe. Everything around me seems unreal. Everywhere I go it looks and feels like America. We've really come a long way down this road, improving our surroundings as we go, changing our roots and culture. But don't you know, long ago there was a working man. Don't you know, and pass the time of day at the working man's cafe.
You still write really good songs. Do you find it hard to do it? Is it, I mean, back in the old days, you guys would put out 2 or 3 albums a year.
Yeah. You know, it's going back to the way I started. Thanks for that. Yeah. That was a quick song to write, actually. And it is very similar to the early songs. Sometimes I didn't write a song. I wrote a record. I knew what it would sound like. Really. Oh, and I remember, especially when It Really Got Me was our first number one in England. And they said, you've got to have a follow-up. I knew what it would sound like. So I wrote the follow-up all day and all of the night. But then I went through a period of writing, let the narrative carry the, the song. And Working Man's Cafe, the song itself, is a combination of both those things. Mm-hmm. I started writing a narrative, and then I knew what it would sound like, and that helped me complete the song. It works that way to me. It's the image appears in a lot of my songs. Songs like Waterloo Sunset and a lot of those See My Friends and those images, they appear first.
And when they appear, are you a pen and paper person? Are you a guitar, piano person? What happens?
It's whatever's closest. there's a song on the new album called Morphine Song that I actually wrote in hospital. I was recovering from an injury in Louisiana.
Yeah.
And I was so frightened, but they were looking at my heartbeat, which was really slow. And I asked the nurse if she'd give me a piece of notepaper, and I wrote the lyrics to that song out on the spot. And when I recorded it, I didn't change one word. So it's whatever's closest. But the images, I think when I start with an image, it's usually on the piano. I don't know why that is. You know, I'm primarily a guitar player, but I do go through the process of trying it on piano.
That impulse to keep what you first write.
Mm.
There's so many different ways of approaching a piece of music. One is to work it to death. Work it to death, I guess, is one way of putting it. But you can work it and make it better, and some people are good at that.
You refine it, make it better, then you go back to the original.
Throw out lots of stuff.
Yeah, it picks up lots of...
Does that happen?
You know, I'm not a book writer, I'm a songwriter. Mm-hmm. But I enjoy writing books, but it's a different process entirely. You can be more editorial with songs. Even more so than with poetry. With poetry, you can elaborate more. And people require you to open up the idea and explore the idea. With songs, generally, it's a three-minute format.
If there wasn't this burst of music that was happening and everybody and their brother forming a band in the 1960s, do you think maybe you would have been an author of books?
I would have needed to have done something creative. Because I think I found it frustrating to go to art school. I knew how to draw and how to paint, but I was frustrated by it. It wasn't fast enough for me. I wanted something, because I was one of those restless youth in the early 60s, I wanted to find something new and exciting. And that's when rock music came into my life, and all those songs I'd heard as a child, I carried the influences of all those into the songs that I wrote subsequently. You know, I love vaudeville. I think you had vaudeville here, but it was a big deal in England, going back to Victorian times.
And it was funny, and it was variety, and...
Yeah, the music halls are great. You know, I really, really loved it. My father took me to one of the last music halls when I was about 5 to see a comedian called Max Miller, and I didn't understand it. He was a bit risque, you know, he was like... I don't know, Chris Rock of his time, I don't know.
But you must have a memory of an atmosphere or something about that that stuck with you.
It stank of cigarettes and booze.
And you spent a bunch of time around that stuff and you're growing.
Yeah, well, I had to go through that. We all go through that phase. And the Kinks, my band, you know, in the mid-70s, we went through, I wrote a song called Demon Alcohol, which was...
great song.
Yeah, which was...
sad memories I can't recall.
Who thought I would fall? A slave to demon alcohol.
I saw you guys once on stage, and it was just a mad fight at the end. I mean, somebody threw something at someone else.
I forget who was president at the time, but we played Washington, a really, really fantastic gig, and the White House aides were there to take us back to the White House afterwards. And when we did alcohol, they all left and didn't get to visit the president.
And probably Nixon. I guess it was Nixon. Pick me something Beck.
It was some guy in a suit.
Pick me another song. We can.
Okay. At art school, my best friend, I grew up in a place called Muswell Hill, Highgate, and I still live up there. My best friend had a party one night, and he had this record on the record player, and I liked it so much I stole it. It's called Honky Tonk by Big Bill Doggett. Big Bill.
Okay, let's listen to it.
Okay. Thank you.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, Bill Doggett played keyboards, yes?
Good question. I know. I just stole the record.
Yeah.
I wasn't interested.
I
didn't finesse it that much. But what was great about that record, I could take it home, play it a few times, and learn how to play the guitar part.
Right.
That's the secret of a lot of these things, you know, the simple riffs, even to a certain extent, the champ, apart from the vibe part. It's all a very simple riff. That's a good thing about those sort of songs. They're easy to play. And I suppose that's the whole thing behind what's so-called garage music, in modern garage rock bands. It's it's accessible to players, you know. Like when You Really Got Me came out, first Kinks hit, people could play it easily. Mm-hmm. Not quite the same, but it was something that could be passed on to people.
Ray, I was in a guitar store last Saturday, walking around, and there was a 13-year-old girl with her mother, and that was the riff she played.
All right.
Yep. Yeah. So it lives.
And she thought she was playing a Van Halen song. Okay.
What does it mean when something that you do, and I hear the sentiment in some of your songs about things living on. Celluloid Heroes is a song sort of about that, about how things live on long after you're gone. Does it resonate with you? Or are you so detached from it because it's so long ago that it doesn't? But here you guys created something and...
Yeah, I try not to think about that too much. Yeah. But when I wrote Celluloid Heroes, I knew there was something, you know, it's very simple chords, but sometimes you put things together and put the words on when you, normally now I do the vocal second, I do the track first and the vocal second. And when that happens, there's some sort of synergy there between the music and the words, and you think, well, this is about as good as I can get it. And if people listen to this in the future, it says a little bit about me as well, as what I'm singing about. I try not to think about that too much, but I know exactly what you're talking about.
Everybody's a dreamer, and everybody's a star, and everybody's in movies. Doesn't matter who you are. There are stars in every city, in every house and on every street. And if you walk down Hollywood Boulevard, their names are written in concrete. Don't step on Greta Garbo as you walk down the boulevard. She looks so weak and fragile, that's why she tried to be so hard. But they turned her into a princess, and they sat her on a throne. But she turned her back on stardom, because she wanted to be alone. You can see all the stars as you walk down Hollywood Boulevard. Some that you recognize, some that you've hardly even heard of. People who worked and suffered and struggled for fame. Some who succeeded and some who suffered in vain.
It is one of those songs that totally sticks with me. And I found, actually, even the last solo record you did and this one, you're still doing it. And can I play one more cut off of yeah. the new record?
Yeah.
There's a cut called Peace in Our Time.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's, you know, it's we live in a difficult world, you know, socially, politically, whatever. But the title sounds quite pompous. But it's about, you know, it's a breakup song and a getting together song. And the never-ending quest for the perfect relationship, and I'm still seeking. and it's some, all this guy wants is to let's bury the hatchet, let's sit down and try and have a life and forget all the quarreling. Of course, but that's the nature of what we are. We're quarrelsome creatures. Yeah, peace in our time.
P-E-A-C-E, I just say.
Absolutely. Peace.
Let's give a listen to.
Yeah, okay. That'll be fun to hear.
'cause the world keeps going round, just like a roller coaster. If you let it, it will crush you down. So we can start to put it back together. Otherwise, we're gonna fall apart.
It's from Working Man's Cafe. I'll put the whole song online for you to hear. And another great song. Did you have fun making this record?
I did. I made it. I started making it. I phoned the record company up and they said, we want another record, but soon. I didn't know the reason why until the record was made. They were going out of business, I think. But I started recording it in England just after an American tour. And I felt uncomfortable there. I didn't like the production team I had. And I just got on a plane, emailed myself all my lyrics, just packed a suitcase and went to Nashville to record it with a bunch of players down there, and did it in like 14, did all the tracking in about 14 days. So it was quite quick. And I did have fun doing it, but I'm not a great traveller. So all the back and forth, you know, to America was a bit strenuous.
But how about that conversation that goes on inside the studio with musicians? Are there musicians you ever knew who knew your work, or did that matter?
They did their research. The rhythm section, quite young guys, and studio guys in Nashville, and the guitar player researched my work. And it was difficult keeping them off playing You Really Got Me and stuff between takes. But we had fun, yeah.
Good.
I was like the father figure. I sort of slapped them down when they were getting too much of a jam band.
Did you ever imagine from a bunch of chords and just doing what was basically riff music and having such a long career at this and still doing it?
Yeah, I never thought, you know, I didn't think past the age of 25 when I started. I remember being on television singing one of my hits when I was 25. And I thought to myself, I remember thinking, I'm too old for this. You know, but I think rock music has come of age and it's become part of the culture, and people can write songs, you know, as you get older. It's better sometimes. But what I enjoyed about this record, it was almost, like I said earlier, going back to the original way of doing things. Just have the idea and bash it down, put it down as soon as possible.
Yeah. Can you imagine ever not writing songs?
Yeah, I can. It is part of me. It's like a workout. You know, I go to the gym quite regularly. It'd be like not going to the gym for me. It'd be writing songs. I like to be creative for like an hour a day. It's something I need. It's inside me now.
You want to take us out on something?
I'll take you out on something. It's really the rock and roll song that really my brother and I, my brother Dave, listening to all this other music, and somehow this, when we first heard this, it put it all together for us, you know, that we wanted to do this, all the influences like the early blues and jazz and jug bands. Somehow there was a boogie beat in this record as well, but it was rock and roll, and it sort of bridged a gap between boogie. If you listen to the rhythm section on this record, it really is like a bebop band, but it's called rock and roll, and it's Sweet Little 16, Chuck Berry. Mm. Everybody knows it.
That's great.
But they can't play it this way.
and he's a pretty good storyteller himself. Lots of great characters in his songs.
You know, I think he's one of the most underrated poets in America. He's some great stories. You know, Maybelline is a great story, you know, and Memphis, Tennessee is a very endearing lyric. Yeah. No, I think he's I never want to meet him because he's a hero. But I love this track, and I have this fantasy half second verse. I think there's some print through from a tape that had an orchestra on it, because years and years, I can hear a synthesizer sound, but it's pre-synth. And, well, I can hear it. Maybe I've got sort of dog ears. Not sure. It's just a great groove, and I never get tired of it, really.
We'll go out on Sweet 16. Chuck Berry, thanks for doing this today. I appreciate it.
Pleasure to be here.
Thanks for all the music all the years. I just, as a small parenthetical, I've seen a lot of shows and a lot of people, and the only record I have in my collection that I've gone out of my way to get an autograph was from you back when a record called Soap Opera came out, because it happened to come out that morning. Yeah. And I ran to some Holiday Inn in College Park, Maryland. Anyway, I just thank you for doing that, and from probably all your fans for taking time to be such a joy and giving us such a great gift over the years.
That's my pleasure. Thanks very much.
Be well.
Good luck.
They're really rocking in Boston and Pittsburgh, PA, deep in the heart of Texas and round the Frisco Bay, all over St. Louis and down in New Orleans. All the cats gonna dance with Sweet Little 16. Sweet Little 16, she just got to have about a half a million a famed autographs. Her wallet filled with pictures, she gets them one by one. Become so excited, watch her look at her run, boy. Philadelphia, PA, deep in the heart.